Edriel began in response, "are not in the archipelago, nor are they in the world of men. They have been taken into the underneath. The Camaros Liber are what guard them. Find them, and find the dragon ships you seek."
"Short and sweet," John muttered under his breath. I hope Bert understood what that meant.
"I suppose I have to answer you now," said Cull. "So go ahead and ask your question, son of Adam."
John thought for a moment, biting his lip in concentration. What to choose? What to ask? Then, suddenly, it came to him. "What are you doing?" he asked. Jack stared at John in amazement. That was not what he had expected his friend to ask, and judging by the expression on Bert's face, he didn't expect it either. The reaction of the Morgaine was different. They looked at one another and nodded, as if confirming something they had suspected but not known until that moment. Even Cull's features softened as she began to answer, although she never stopped unravelling the tapestry.
"Well asked, young caretaker John," she said, her voice a soft purr. "You understand that all that happens is not mere cause and effect, but that there are causes underlying causes, and it is those that truly shape the events of history. The world is unravelling. Someone has changed time itself, and a new event has taken place that was not in the tapestry before. Thus, we must unweave all that has happened since, for a new weaving must be created. You may ask another question."
"Do you have to unweave the entire tapestry?"
Again came the nods, as if this question also met with their approval.
"No," said Cull. "We must unravel it only to the moment of the change. 7 centuries passed. You may ask another question."
"What caused the change?" asked John.
"Caretakers of the Imaginarium Geographica,"
Cull replied, turning fully to stare at them.
"You did."
Jack snorted. "Of course," he said flippantly. "We just went backward in time 700 years and accidentally killed Genghis Khan, or stepped on a butterfly, or something equally catastrophic."
"That can't be,"
Bert protested, with no hint of irony or mockery.
"If that had happened, we would have a historical record of some sort."
"That's why you're unravelling the tapestry now. Because the event that changed things didn't happen 7 centuries ago, did it?" John asked the Morgaine.
"No," said Ceridwen. "It happened 9 years ago."
"We have answered all the questions agreed upon," said Celedriel, "and more, because you have shown yourself to be wise. And because of the wisdom of your questions, we will offer you one further answer to do with as you will,"
Cull intoned.
"The unravelling began when history was changed, but the thread was first loosened when 2 brothers made a choice. Both of them believed his choice may have been wrong. One of them was. When you determine which, and in what way, you may yet have a chance to save the children of this world and your own."
As a group, the companions exited the cave, shielding their eyes from the glare of daylight. They went across the clearing and sat to discuss what the Morgaine had said. Over near the cottages, Charles had cornered Magwitch by brandishing a pair of hedge shears and making suggestive threats about what might get pruned if he didn't keep his distance and stay quiet. Jack waved for Charles to come over and join them. He left the Green Knight muttering to himself and kicking stones, and trotted over to the others, where Jack quickly filled him in on what had transpired in the cave.
"John's a deeper thinker than I have given him credit for," said Charles. "I react too much in the moment, I'm afraid. I wouldn't have had the sense to ask what he did."
"Nor did I," said Jack.
What made you think of it, John?
He shrugged. I don't know. It just seemed to me in that moment that if these women were as important and powerful as Bert has always claimed they are, then perhaps what they were doing had a larger purpose. I simply got lucky that it did.
Not luck, said Bert. Intuition. The best skill of a caretaker, and you have it in spades. By the way, what do you make of their answer to Jack?
That the dragon ships are guarded by the Caminus Liber? John asked.
I'm not sure. It sounds familiar. Liber is Latin. It means book. Caminus, I'm not entirely certain of. It sounds Greek, maybe.
So we'll find the missing ships in a book, said Charles. I'm not sure that helps as clues go.
I'm afraid the rest of what they've told us only makes things worse, observed Bert.
Not sure how it can get worse, said Charles.
The story they told, Bert said, about time itself being broken, I can't think of anything more dangerous.
We haven't noticed so far, reasoned Charles, so I don't know why it would bother you so.
Two reasons, Bert said, his face darkening. One, you're correct. We wouldn't notice if history had been changed, because everything that follows will change accordingly, including our own memories. But the second reason is worse.
Why? Asked John.
Because, Bert explained, lifting his head, if the change was indeed our fault, caused by something that happened 9 years ago, then it's possible our memories of that event have also been altered.
John slapped his forehead. Meaning there might be no way to know what caused the damage to begin with.
Exactly, said Bert. We must battle the effect, even though we may never know the cause, because in our time, it may never have happened at all.
It took less than a half hour for the companions to make their way back to where the Indigo Dragon was anchored, and there was no further discussion of what had transpired in the cave. This was in part because each of them was turning the revelations over and over in his head, thinking, and in part because the Green Knight never stopped complaining.
But why? Magwitch whined. Just tell me what they said. It was my question after all.
Oh, for heaven's sake,
Charles said, rolling his eyes. He turned and took the shabby knight by the shoulders.
Do you want to know why life is so unfair? Well, I'll tell you. It's because you are a bitter, twisted, heartless villain with a lump of coal for a heart who has never done a damn thing except for the most selfish reasons, no matter the suffering it has caused those around you. What's more, you never learn from your mistakes. You just keep doing the same stupid things over and over and over, and will probably end up spending the rest of your eternity all alone on this island, until you finally crumble away to dust, having perished alone, unmourned, and unloved.
Magwitch stared at Charles, who was breathing hard from his extended rant, before he finally blinked, then blinked again. Then, without warning, Magwitch burst into tears and collapsed against Charles, sobbing.
Oh, good job, Charles, declared Jack. You've completely destroyed the poor fellow.
Ah,
said Charles as he dragged the whimpering, slobbering knight over to a rock where he sat him down.
Here,
he said to Magwitch, offering a handkerchief.
Do wipe the, sap off of your face. That's a good fellow.
But you're absolutely right, wailed Magwitch. I'm a terrible person, and I deserve everything that's happened to me. Why, if there were any justice in the world, you'd just chip me off of firewood right now. And even then, the embers from my fire would probably burn a hole in your coat.
He threw up his arms and started such a pitiful keening that even Bert had to cover his ears.
Kindling! That's all I'm good for. I'll never do anyone any good.
Now, that's not true, said Charles. I'm sure you're not completely devoid of redeeming qualities.
Really?
Magwitch said, sniffing.
Like what?
Don't look at us, John said to Charles. You opened the door.
Well, Charles
stammered, rubbing his temples.
Give me a minute. I'm sure I can come up with something.
You have to think about it, sobbed Magwitch. I'm irredeemable, aren't I?
No one is completely irredeemable, said Charles. But I must say...
His face went slack and his eyes widened as an idea occurred to him.
You know, Magwitch, he suggested, perhaps we're looking at this the wrong way.
Oh, so? Sniffed the knight.
Every story has a villain or two,
Charles replied matter-of-factly.
And while you are more of a minor villain, I have to say you're far more irritating than the Winter King ever was. In fact, being despicable may just be your great talent in life.
You really think so? Said Magwitch. I don't understand.
Look, Charles explained, you know I despise you, right?
You've made it very clear, yes, said Magwitch.
Well, Charles continued, whenever we've met, you've demonstrated all the qualities I don't want to have. And I try to better myself so I don't become like you. So in a way...
My bad example is making you a better person, finished Magwitch.
Something like that, said Charles. If it wasn't for people like you, I don't think I would try so hard. And honestly, you're the worst I've ever encountered.
Oh, you're just saying that, said Magwitch.
No, I really mean it, said Charles.
I think I'm going to be sick, Jack declared. Charles, it's time to go. Charles stood and clapped the Green Knight on the back.
All right, then, he said. Good. Don't ever change, Magwitch.
Oh, I won't,
said the knight, glancing backward across the island.
So, do you think the three ladies in the cave would like some company?
Charles frowned.
I can't say, Magwitch. It wouldn't hurt to ask, he said, climbing up the ladder. I think.
Farewell, caretakers,
Magwitch called over his shoulder as he clanked his way up the hill. What do you think will happen to him? Asked John.
They'll probably turn him into a toad, said Charles, but I don't think he'll notice.
We must get to Parillon immediately,
Bert said as the Indigo Dragon moved away from Avalon and toward the dark, roiling clouds that formed the frontier.
Artus must be told all of this. The Morgaine do not often offer information so freely. The situation must be very dire for them to have said as much as they did.
Jack had moved to the rear of the deck, away from the others, thinking about the prince. The High King's son. Avon's son. A son who, in other circumstances, might have been his own. Whatever course John or Bert or Charles might decide, Jack's direction was clear. The others could pursue the missing dragon ships and find the children. But Jack would not let another night pass without doing everything in his power to find the missing son of his one great love, or perish in the attempt. Chapter 7. The Great What's-It. The journey to Parillon was uneventful, too much so in Bert's estimation. He kept scuttling back and forth from port to starboard, peering over the edge and making worried clucking sounds with his tongue.
It's like the calm before the storm, he confided to John.
The weather is beautiful, John said, looking around at the nearly cloudless sky.
It's not the weather I'm concerned with, replied Bert. It's the fact that we're almost to Parillon, and we've yet to see a single ship on the water below.
That's right, put in Charles. There ought to be trade ships full of apples going to and fro, or at the least, several fishing vessels.
And yet, not even a dinghy, Bert said. This bodes very ill, I'm afraid.
The extent of Bert's worries was confirmed as they approached the island kingdom itself. Smoke ringed the harbour ahead of them, and a haze in the distance indicated that other fires had been set elsewhere on Parillon.
You know, said Charles, I'd really like to visit this place when someone hasn't set it on fire. Just once, mind you.
Below it was starkly obvious. There were no ships of any kind in the harbour or at the docks. There had been a few, but those were the source of the smoke. They'd been set ablaze. Far beneath them, they could see crews of workers and sailors trying vainly to staunch the flames on vessels that were already lost.
"What the devil?" exclaimed Bert. "I haven't been gone a day. What can have happened in a day?"
"A lot," Jack said darkly, "if the day in question happened 700 years ago." Bert piloted the airship, past the smoke, and headed into the city proper, which was built around and against the great tower of rock upon which the great castle of the Silver Throne stood. He found a broad cobblestone plaza that was nearly devoid of people, and slowly set the Indigo Dragon down. The carriage settled heavily onto the street, and the propellers gradually came to a stop.
"The palace is just up the boulevard," Bert said, "but I wanted to stop and pick up a spare Geographica and say hello to an old friend while we're at it."
Across the plaza, amidst shops selling pieces of the North Wind, 50 centimes a bag, and bezoars, and enchanted violins, was a small shopfront that was apparently dedicated to the sale of a single item, the Imaginarium Geographica. Piles of the books were the only things on display within and without the store. A small figure burst through the door to a jangling of bells.
"Bless my soul," he said, voice quivering with emotion. "Be it the Scowlers, my friends, returned to us at long last."
"Tamala," Charles shouted, as he raced forward and embraced the little badger. "Tamala, it's grand to see you again."
"I'd be filled with joyful thoughts myself, Scowler Charles," Tamala said, wiping at his tear-filled eyes with a paw. "And Scowler Jack, and Scowler John, too. This be a day of days, it be."
Jack and John both greeted their furry friend warmly, while Charles stepped inside the shop.
"I say, Tamala," Charles began, "you have quite an enterprise going here."
He handed copies of the oversized book to both Jack and John, and all three made noises of praise and astonishment. The book was roughly the shape of the real Geographica, and had a tooled leather cover, but it also bore an illustrated jacket and was annotated entirely in English.
"The language of Oxford Scowlers, you know," explained Tamala proudly.
"Tamala, I'm greatly impressed," said Charles.
"I'm speechless," said John, flipping through the pages. "Most of the major islands are here, and with better notes than I remember."
"And look," Jack pointed out, "it's got an introduction by the king."
"It was a favour," Tamala admitted, "but it helped get the word out."
"How did you do this, Tum?" John asked. "You even have Terminus in here."
The badger held up his paws and shrugged.
"Badgers have good memories," he explained. "I just wrote what I remembered when I came back to Parallon, and Bert helped me with copies of the maps."
"I'm terribly impressed," Charles said again, patting his small friend on the back.
"Thanks muchly," said Tumbler, beaming. "I does what I can."
"Don't let the humility fool you," said Bert. "He sold through 4 printings of the concise edition of the Imaginarium Geographica to date."
5, Tumbler corrected. "We've only just delivered the last of the inventory to the libraries at Prydain. At least, I hope they arrived, what with all the troubles."
"What's happened to the ships, Tamala?" asked Bert.
"No one knows," replied the badger, "but peoples think it's a curse what began after the dragon ships disappeared."
"What's cursed?" Jack asked.
"The rest of the ships in the archipelago," said Tamala. "They're all cursed. In a single night, we found all of them sunk or put to the torch. And worse, any new ships being built seem to sink the minute they're put to sea. Just fall apart before your eyes. And as a result..."
"Everything in the archipelago has been disconnected," concluded John somberly. "All the unity that was achieved by the creation of the Geographica and the rule of the High King..."
"Utterly in a shambles," finished Bert. "At least we still have Tamala's copies of the Geographica. By now, they're on every land in the archipelago."
"So everyone knows where everything is," said Jack, "but no one can get anywhere."
"That's been the problem," agreed Tamala. "The king and queen have been using the great cranes of Byblos to take messages back and forth. But that only works for the nearby islands. The rest..."
are completely cut off,
Charles finished.
We'd better get to the palace, said Bert. We must speak to Artus.
He turned to Tumala.
We find ourselves in need of a geographica, Master Tumala. We've, neglected to bring along our own. May we purchase a copy from you?
Purchase? You mean buy a copy of my book?
Tumala said as his eyes grew wide.
Of course not. There'd be no charge for Oxford scholars to have a geographica.
With that, the little badger scurried around them, pulling two clean, undamaged copies from the bottom of the pile and handing them to Jack and Charles. Then he raced to a small office at the back of the shop and returned a minute later with another copy for John that seemed slightly different from the others. With extreme sincerity and gravity, Tumala presented the book to John.
For the master caretaker, Tumala said soberly, this be my own original book, copied from yours. I want you to have it, Scowler John.
Tumala,
I can't accept this,
John protested, holding up his hands.
You made it yourself. That's why I wants it to be yours, insisted Tumala. It's not as clean as the ones what we printed, but it's got character.
John finally acquiesced and took the gift as graciously as he could manage. Thank you, Tumala. I'm sure it will come in very handy.
I say, Tumala, said Charles, would you mind signing mine, just for old time's sake? Sign? You mean like an autograph? Oh, Master Scholars,
Tumala said, nearly swooning.
This be the proudest day in old Tumala's life.
The little badger removed a quill from one of his pockets and carefully inscribed his name in all three books.
One last favour to ask, if I may, Bert began.
No need to ask, Tumala said, beaming. When I saw you land in the Indigo Dragon, I already started up the curious diversity out back. I figured you'd been needing a lift to the archive.
Charles thumped him on the back again and grinned.
Good old Tumala. We're not going to the palace?
Asked Charles as Tumala guided the steam-belching vehicle onto one of the broad streets that led to the northern part of the island.
Don't we need to consult with Artus, that is, the High King? That's where I'll be taking you, Scowler Charles,
the badger said without taking his eyes from the road ahead.
To the King!
As they travelled, Bert explained just how drastically things had changed in the archipelago, particularly in regard to the Palace of Parallon, where the High King and Queen sat on the silver throne. On the outside, it looked much the same as it had when they had last been there. It was still a mighty and impressive edifice, and a number of ministers and officials circulated around an axis somewhere in the centre, represented by King Artus. But it was no longer the true seat of authority in the archipelago. Rather than embrace and revel in the trappings of authority, wealth and power, as would almost anyone who found themselves heir to a throne, Artus had apparently eschewed ceremony and was conducting the affairs of the kingdom in the ruins of the old city, the first built by his ancestor Artigal, son of Arthur. Artus reportedly liked to conduct affairs of state while sprawled on his stomach behind a makeshift throne in a vast hall with only half a ceiling. On the floor, he examined maps and parchments and a pile of various reports that was constantly being added to by the continuous stream of officials who made the trek from the palace.
He wasn't in Parallon for a year, Bert said, before he moved everything here, lock, stock and Powderhorn. It turns out he had a passion for the old archives, and I dare say it's made him a better ruler for it.
What do you know, said Jack.
The potboy turned out to be a scholar after all. Tumala guided the curious diversity along the bottom of the canyon, which had been recently paved. They glided smoothly past the great doors that led to Samaranth's treasure hoard without so much as a swerve in its direction.
Shouldn't we be consulting Samaranth as well? Asked John.
After all, he's probably the oldest creature in the archipelago.
Considered, said Bert. But he's gone with the rest of his kind searching for the dragon ships. And he may be old, but his knowledge is broad, not deep.
Other than the royal family and the caretakers, he hasn't paid as much attention to mankind as you'd think.
That's 'cause you're still a young race, Tamala commented over his shoulder. Give it time, and you might yet turn out to be an interesting people.
I can't imagine that Avon agreed to come here, Jack said, glancing around at the steep stone walls to either side of the road. It would take more persuasion than I'm capable of to get her to move this far from the sea. Tamala began to reply, but a raised eyebrow and slight shake of the head from Bert silenced him. Swallowing hard, the little animal increased his speed, and in short order they arrived at their destination.
"Well, Master Scowlers," Tamala announced,
beaming as if he'd built the place himself.
"Here we be, the great what's-it."
Before them, carved deep into the granite walls of a junction in the canyon, were several towers of stone, accented and buttressed by wooden beams and golden embellishments. The structures were carved along the strata of the rock, and so the entire edifice resembled nothing so much as a great, glittering, mica pipe organ.
"Great what's-it?"
Jack asked.
"Oh, that's just the nickname we animals give it," said Tamala. "On account of the king can never decide what it is. Is it a library? Or an archive? Or a city? Or just a pile of rock? Or all of that at once? So we just began to call it the Great What's-It, and the name stuck."
"But don't tell the king I told you that," Tamala said to Charles.
"Decorum and all."
"Won't breathe a word of it,"
Charles assured him as the companions said their farewells to the little mammal, thanking him again for the copies of the Geographica.
"It's nothing," he said,
doing the badger equivalent of a blush and shuffle.
"I was happy to do it, and glad to give you a ride, but I need to tend my shop. Commerce never sleeps, you know."
"We do," said Jack.
"Where to now, Bert?"
"This way," Bert gestured. "We just need to follow the smell of decaying parchment, and we'll find the High King."
Unlike the palace at Paralon, which was structurally ordered with geometric precision, the old city of Artigal was built according to geologic rules. As flowed the stone, so flowed the rooms. John had the fleeting thought that it resembled a labyrinth, and for a moment had a chill of premonition. But the thought vanished when they entered a spacious chamber, distinguished both by its lack of decoration, save for the immense mess of documents scattered throughout, and its primary occupant. Sprawled on the floor, Artus was deep in concentration, pausing only to scribble a note on a sheet of parchment, or mutter an irritated,
"Yes, yes,"
when asked a direct question by one of his advisers hovering nearby. And so it was that they were nearly standing on top of him before he even noticed the companion's presence.
"What is it? What is it?"
said Artus without glancing up.
"I am issuing edicts as fast as I am able, as you can plainly see."
"Take your time," replied John. "We've only come from the summer country, but I suppose we can wait for the king." At the sound of John's voice, Artus jumped to his feet, scattering parchment everywhere.
"What is this? What is this?"
he exclaimed excitedly.
"My dear friends, you've come at last."
Whatever else they may have been expecting, this reaction from the king, no less, took the companions completely off guard. The slightly gawky youth they had known as Bug had grown into a barrel-chested man who was taller and broader than any of them, and his reception of them was so unabashedly giddy that they couldn't help but respond in kind. Each of them in turn gave Artus a hug, and he slapped them on the back so repeatedly that they thought their teeth might fall out. The deference the officials and ministers gave to Artus underscored the fact that he was indeed king, but underneath, he was the same friend they remembered.
"So happy to see you," Artus said. "You made great time. We dispatched Bert only yesterday."
"We had an advance warning," said John. "There's a lot we need to tell you, Bug."
"Better make it Artus or your majesty inside the, archive, library,"
Artus said, with a furtive glance around at some of his underlings.
"I prefer Bug myself, but it's harder to motivate people when they have to take orders from a King Bug."
"Let's stick to Artus, then," declared Charles. "I'm not sure I can fit Bug and your majesty together in my brain at the same time."
It took a long while for the companions to explain everything that had transpired, during which Artus ordered several trays of food brought in, which the servants spread around them on the floor.
"I hope you don't mind," Artus said apologetically. "I'm just so much more comfortable working here on the floor. I throw back to my early days on Avalon, I suppose. The old witches didn't let me have any furniture, so I had to learn to make do. I can't quite get used to the fancy thrones and banquet halls and whatnot. Sure," he continued, "every so often for an official function, we have to put on the robes and do all that kingly stuff. But mostly, I like to spend time working among the people in the shops and on the docks. When they're not on fire, that is," he added.
"It's fine," John assured him.
"What do you know about the ships? Who's setting them ablaze?"
"We don't know," said the king. "But everything you've told me has sparked an idea. Come with me."
Artus jumped to his feet.
"I want to show you something."
Artus led them through several cavernous rooms, piled with loose papers that seemed newly made, fresh. They were certainly not typical archive materials. Past those rooms, they came before a great set of doors, guarded by two powerful-looking elves.
"I've noticed a number of elves around the, archive," Jack remarked.
"Yes," said Artus. "When the Blue Dragon was taken, King Elladir sent several other ships here to shore up any defense we might need, and those were the first ships to burn. So we've put the elves to work in places that need greater security." "It's fitting that they're here in the old city," he continued. "It was elven craftsmen who built many of the structures here, and especially the doors, but these are special."
He pointed up at the intricately carved figures that ringed the arch at the top of each door.
"These were built by a legendary craftsman who was rumored to be half-elf and half-troll. Made him crazy as a bedbug, but the work he did was second to none."
As he spoke, Artus removed his ring, the symbol of his office, and pressed it into a nearly imperceptible depression in the metal frame. There was an audible click from inside the doors, and only then did the guards relax their stance to allow the visitors to pass.
"I read somewhere that the rings and the locking mechanism were both carved from a lodestone," said Artus, "but I haven't the faintest idea what that is."
He opened the massive doors. Inside, they saw a honeycomb of shelves upon shelves filled with bound books, sheets of parchment, and rolls of papyrus, all in an incredible state of disarray.
"Please forgive the mess," Artus said mildly. "The main body of the library has been moved now and again, and we keep adding new materials before we've had a chance to fully catalogue what we already have."
"So this is the great what's-it," Charles said, unable to disguise the admiration in his voice. "I wonder what old Craigie at the OED would think about this, eh, John?"
"Ah," said Artus, "I see Tumala's been talking. No, it's okay," he added,
when Charles began to stammer an apology.
"I know that's what the animals began calling it. So does just about everyone else. It's not a bad name, Great What's It. It's better than what Avon called it, which, I can't really repeat. Lots of sailors' words and the like, you know."
It was the first time Artus had mentioned Avon in any context at all, and he did so in such a matter-of-fact way that none of the companions could discern anything from the remark. Artus turned away from his friends, cupped his hands to his mouth, and bellowed,
"Solomon! Solomon Claw!"
In response to his call, an enormous black crow dropped down from the dark recesses of the ceiling above and perched on the desk next to Artus. The bird wore glasses on the end of a giant, dusk-grey beak and a tight-fitting cleric's vest. Charles half expected to see spats on its feet as well.
"Oh, Solomon," Artus said, "how goes the work?"
"Gow, gow, gows, as it gow, gow, gows,"
the crow replied in a voice that sounded like a willow branch being swished through a pile of dry leaves.
"We five, five files the books, and now, now notes the files, as we have been doing these many centuries, our king."
"Well done, my good, bird," said Artus. "I need to ask, have you a catalogue of myths dating back,
he turned to Bert.
7 centuries, said Bert, give or take.
Without a word, the crow dipped its head, spread its wings, and disappeared into the stacks.
Can't beat crows for organizing a library, said Artus. We used to also have a staff of very efficient hedgehogs, but when the crows arrived, there was an unfortunate misunderstanding at the commissary, and it's just been crows ever since.
A few of these look singed, John observed, examining a stack of papyrus rolls. Did someone get a little careless and leave them too close to a lamp? Artus peered over John's shoulder at the rolls.
Oh, those! They're from the old collection, in your world, he said. There was indeed a fire, but fortunately, a number of scholars with ties to the archipelago were able to rescue them before too much damage was done. Actually, he continued, it was from these old documents that Arthur took the original seal of the High King.
The Alpha? Said Charles. So these are Greek?
Yes, on both counts, Artus replied, although I think they also used it to indicate the library these came from, a place called Alexandria, in the country of,
Egypt, said John, dumbfounded.
Alexandria is in Egypt.
Right, said Artus. That's what they originally called this mess before it was the Great What's-It, or the Royal Library, or the Archive of Parallon. It was called the Library of Alexandria.
Chapter 8. The Friar's Tale. Solomon Caw returned with a thick, hide-bound book clutched in his talons. Wings stroking mightily, he lowered the book gently to the nearby tabletop, then ducked his head in deference to the king and flew away.
"Allow me," said Artus. "It is my archive, after all."
He opened the old tome and began scanning the pages intently, running his fingers along the faded writing and murmuring softly to himself.
Artus, John began. A moment, please, the king replied. I'm just getting oriented. Even after years of studying them, I'm still finding my way around these old languages, you know.
But, said John, interrupted Artus. I realize you have specialized training, but so do I. There's nothing you can do to make the translation process go any faster. Fine, John said, shrugging. Read on. After a minute or so of examining one page, then another and another, it became obvious to all of them that the High King was stumped.
May I make a suggestion? Offered John.
All right, Artus said, finally resigned, but I doubt you'll have an easier time of it. His voice trailed off as John stepped forward and turned the old book upside down.
There, said John. Give that a go.
It's Latin, Artus said, crestfallen.
Now?
Why don't we all have a look together? Charles suggested. More eyes to the work and all that.
The king put the book in the middle of the table, and the others leaned in closely to read.
This is one of the histories, said Bert in astonishment. One of the official records written by the caretakers.
I thought the caretakers just annotated the maps in the Geographica, said John. We're meant to write histories too.
It's not an obligation, Bert explained. But caretakers have witnessed many happenings in the history of the Earth, and felt compelled to record them. Originally, as with this volume and the many others like it, the accounts were simple and straightforward. It was only centuries later that we realized such documents could be dangerous in the wrong hands, and began fictionalizing our writings.
As you did with the time machine, said Jack.
Yes, said Bert, and others. Jules did it too, and Cervantes, Shakespeare. A lot of real history, biography, and geography can be found in the fiction of the world. At least, he added with a wink, those fictions written by caretakers. This one was written by Geoffrey of Monmouth's immediate successor, said Bert, Robert Wace. He also had a lot to say about the Arthurian histories.
I remember, said John. He wrote a French version of Geoffrey's Arthurian compilations and dedicated it to Eleanor of Aquitaine. He's also the source of the story about Arthur's legendary round table.
It isn't actually round, Artus confided to Charles. It's more oblong, but it still served the same purpose, I think.
What does it say about the message? Asked Jack. Does it say anything about a crusade?
The actual crusades in your world had already begun nearly a century earlier, said Bert, but I don't think the message had anything to do with those. We have two clues to go on. First, Jamie mentioned a memory of a crusade myth. Then the Morgaine said that something had changed time, and they both alluded to it as an event that happened 7 centuries ago. 700 years ago, the caretaker was Master Wace, and he spent a great deal of time in the archipelago working on histories of his own. If there is a myth about a crusade dating to that time, I can't imagine he wouldn't have known about it and written it down.
I agree, said John. The warning came from the archipelago. It won't be an event that took place back in our world that we're looking for.
Well, it's not that long a history,
Charles said, tracing across the book's thickness with his thumb.
Between us, we should be able to skim through it in an hour or two.
Just then, Solomon Kaur dropped back down from the gloom at the top of the room, with a second identical book in his talons, followed closely by a flock of other crows, all carrying books that they lowered into an ever-increasing pile on and around the desk.
I told you, Bert said. Master Wace spent a lot of time here, and he loved to write.
Just how many history books did he write? Asked John.
43,
replied Solomon Kaur.
I'll order some more food and drink, said Artus. This is going to take a while.
As an academic exercise, poring over nearly 4 dozen incunabula would have been considered a fine weekend activity by John, Jack, and Charles. Artus, aided by Bert, had a slightly slower time of it, but demonstrated a facility for quickly summarizing complex material that none of them would have guessed he had. As an exercise of discovery, however, it was an absolute failure. Nothing in any of the books referred to a crusade taking place in the archipelago for a 200-year span. There were events of import, and skirmishes and minor wars. John had found a 10-page account of something called the Chicken War of Griffin Bay, but nothing that hinted at any solutions to their growing list of problems.
Well, Artus said jovially, still not a bad way to pass an afternoon, all things considered.
Not a bad way to...
Jack began, rising to his feet.
Damn your eyes, Artus! We've been in here for hours now. We've been thumbing through old books, and eating, and generally having a leisurely afternoon of it, when we should be out there, looking for your son.
Neither Artus nor the others said anything, but merely waited so Jack could finish saying what he needed to say. John and Charles had also wondered why their friend was not more concerned with his missing son, but they didn't feel it was their place to address it. Jack's motivations, however, ran deeper.
I'm sorry, Artus, he said, but it must be said. How can you be expected to solve the problems of an entire kingdom if you can't even spare a moment's concern for your own son?
Artus uncrossed his legs and stood up. Without a word, he strode from the room, only to return moments later with an armful of the papers that had been piled in the rooms they'd passed through earlier. He brusquely shoved Master Wace's histories off the tabletop and dropped the papers on it. The pile was so large that many papers slid to the floor.
It hasn't been 2 days since the ships started to vanish, Artus began, his back to them and his voice soft. We can't really determine how long ago the children began disappearing, but their abductor knew we'd take quicker notice of the dragon ships being gone than if we couldn't find a few misbehaving children. We took even more notice yesterday when the yellow dragon, the Nautilus, vanished with my boy aboard. Avon and I, thought it would be the safest.
Artus stood straighter.
When the reports of the missing children began to come in, we thought he'd be safer there, aboard a living ship, one that could take action on its own, if the situation demanded it. Then the elves arrived and anchored their ships alongside, and I don't think I could have arranged a better, more secure place if you'd asked. I even considered taking him to Terminus, except it would have been too long a journey. Then, the yellow dragon vanished altogether, and the elven ships were set ablaze. The guards were killed, their throats cut, and there was no way to follow the missing ship, because no one had seen it go. It had simply vanished. That's when I summoned Bert and instructed him to seek you out.
Then why, Artus, said Jack, if you knew more help was coming, why didn't you set out then to go find your son?
In answer, Artus pointed to the pile of papers on the table. John stepped forward and looked at one of the topmost papers, then another. Their letters,
he told the others.
Correct, said Artus. They began coming in 3 days ago, but my steward only brought them to my attention yesterday, just before the yellow dragon vanished. At last count, we have 6,800 letters, and more were coming in before the ships were put to the torch. And every one of them is from a mother or father who lost a child in the night. Every one.
He turned to look at them, a quiet resolve on his face. This was no longer their old friend, the potboy of Avalon, talking. This was a man who had realized what it truly meant to be given a kingdom.
What I've been doing, Artus said, looking directly at Jack, is directing the affairs of Parallon and the associated island states and city-states who have representatives here to try to control an uncontrollable crisis. You were here with me the last time a crisis arose, and there was no one man, one leader, to whom the archipelago could turn for guidance. I don't know if I'm able, but like it or not, I'm the High King. The people here trust that I will make the choices that will help us all, not just those that benefit me. So how could I possibly have left this to my steward and the other officials just to go look for my own son, when there is no one else in authority here to look out for the thousands of others who are lost?
Jack couldn't speak, but simply extended his hand in response. Artus took it with no hesitation, then clapped his friend on the shoulder.
Besides, he said, if there were anyone on Earth who would see the value of saving the world through library maintenance, it had to be the three Scowlers from Oxford.
Charles snapped his fingers.
Oxford men! I say, Artus, that may be the key.
He turned to Bert.
Whom did you say was the caretaker after Wace?
Easy to find out, Artus interjected. Just check the list in the end papers of the Geographica.
Quickly, Charles opened the book Tumler had given him to the list of names in the front.
I wrote the introduction for that, you know, Artus said to Jack. On market day, I've even been asked for my autograph.
You don't say, Jack replied.
Here it is, said Charles. Roger Bacon had it after Wace. And didn't he spend a lot of time here?
Much, said Bert. But he didn't assume the role until the Crusades were over, or nearly so at any rate.
It couldn't be a better perspective for a historian, stated John, to be able to document events not too distant to not have credible accounts, but with enough years past that there's some objectivity.
Maybe, Charles said, but that's not why I'm asking. Remember what Laura Glue said? She said that the ones coming for the children were clockworks.
Impossible, Artus said flatly. After the disaster with the Parliament 9 years ago, we outlawed the construction of clockworks. The animals had the best intentions, but they were too easily manipulated by Magwitch.
The clockworks or the animals? Asked John.
Both, said Artus. It took 18 months just to round up and destroy the false Parliament. The Queen of Spades was one of the harder ones to find. She managed to disguise herself as a cow. We might never have found her if she'd just kept out of the milking rotation.
Ouch, said John.
Oh, she was fine, the King said, but she beheaded 3 farmers before we caught her out. So did you destroy them all? Asked Bert.
For all intents and purposes, said Artus. The King of Hearts was the last, and we only found pieces of him.
My point, said Charles, is that Laura Glue did say she saw and heard the clockwork men coming, and I, for one, believe her.
What does that have to do with Roger Bacon? Said Jack.
He's the one who taught the secrets of building clockworks to the animals, said Bert. Them and Nemo, and no others. And he did it just about 7 centuries ago.
It took only a half hour for Solomon Caw to locate the histories of Roger Bacon, and there were many. Fortunately, they were also among the better indexed books in the library, and so the companions were able to set aside all but a handful as unnecessary. The remaining books were mostly thick vellum, lettered by a hand in a crisp and pointed script. The books dating to the time in question included compilations of magic and mysteries from across the continents of the world, the Picatrix from Arabia, the complete writings of Aristotle from Greece, and many more. Most interesting to the companions was a heavy book titled The Key of Solomon,
which contained spells and formulas Bacon claimed had been created by the great Hebrew king himself. In the latter portion of the book were sketches and diagrams of machines and annotations on how to build them. There were vehicles like Tamala's principle, the curious diversity, directions for building mechanical men and women, like the false kings and queens of the Parliament, and even rudimentary drawings of aircraft.
"These must be fakes," said John. "Those are obviously sketches from Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks."
Bert shook his head.
"Leo swiped all of that from Bacon, who got much of it from King Solomon. The difference is, Bacon gave due credit to Solomon. Leo just preened about pretending to be a genius."
"I am astonished," said Charles. "Leonardo da Vinci?"
"He had a lot of potential," said Bert, sighing. "Then Michelangelo came along, and all bets were off. After that, it was all about trying to show up the newcomer."
"Salieri and Mozart," said John.
"Precisely," agreed Bert. "Except Salieri didn't have someone better to steal from. Leo had Roger Bacon."
"At least we know the Mona Lisa was authentically his, anyway," said Charles.
In response, Bert laid a finger along his nose and looked over the books they'd set aside. In a moment, he'd found the one he wanted and opened it to a center-spread engraving, which he showed to Charles.
"My God!"
Charles exclaimed.
"Then who was she, really?"
"A kitchen maid from the court of King Edward," said Bert. "I imagine she was smiling, because Bacon was doing something profane while he sketched her."
"Well, that's one mystery solved," said Charles.
"I think I've found something," said Artus, who'd been reading as the others talked. "It's in a Latin grammar, which he seems to have been developing as a primer for some of the languages in the archipelago."
Artus sat with the book, and the others crowded behind him for a look. He pointed at a passage written in the margins.
"Here! It looks as if he wanted to record a happening and had no other materials to write on. See?"
he said, thumbing through the sheets of vellum.
"It goes on for several pages."
"What makes you think it's important, Artus?" asked John.
"This,"
said the king, indicating at the second page.
"He refers to the construction of two mechanical men, but calls them by name before the task has been completed. So perhaps they weren't entirely mechanical after all."
"Half man and half machine," said Jack.
"That's quite a concept, especially for the 13th century."
"He calls them Hugh the Iron and William the Pig," continued Artus, reading.
"They may have been..." "John, can you read this?"
John leaned closer and examined the text.
"Brothers?
Or comrades, maybe. It's unclear, but it does indicate that they may have represented his first experiment with constructing clockworks, even if they began as men. It says there was a shipwreck of some kind, and they were nearly killed. Bacon may have saved their lives. They were both mortally wounded, and..."
"How strange," said John.
"Bacon also says that he thought they were deaf, but that it turned out their ears had been sealed with beeswax."
"That's all interesting enough," put in Jack. "But what makes you think it's relevant to what's occurring now?"
"The last paragraph,"
said Artus excitedly. "I think this is the myth the caretaker in London was referring to. Can you translate, John? You're faster than I."
Artus stood and let the caretaker take his seat. Clearing his throat, John began to translate the sharp writing. "It says that when he had made new men of them, Hugh the Iron and William the Pig repaid him by turning on him and beating him nearly to death. Only the presence of several animals, including, strangely, chickens, and a friendly griffin, saved him. Bacon writes that the brothers seemed to be entranced or enchanted, but the whole time they were beating him, they did not speak. Suddenly, the sky grew dark and seemed to split into shards, which fell to the horizon. A great shape, absent of form, rose and covered the sky, and Bacon swears that all the while, he could hear the faint notes of a children's rhyme being whistled or played, perhaps on a pipe. Then, from the shattered sky, a great ship appeared and beached itself in front of them. Hugh moved to one side of it and William to the other, and each of them placed a hand upon the prow, then together began to recite a verse. By right and rule, for need of might, we two bind thee, we two bind thee. By blood bound, by honour given, we too bind thee, we too bind thee. For strength and speed and heaven's power, by ancient claim in this dark hour, we too bind thee, we too bind thee. John's voice had dropped to a whisper. That's uncomfortably close to another verse I once heard read. Artus nodded slowly in understanding. The summoning for the dragons in the ring on Terminus. But as I interpreted it, that could only have been spoken effectively by one of royal blood. Me, specifically.
'Tis true, said Bert. There are very few spoken spells that have any true power. Not enough to count on two hands. One is the summoning, but another is the binding, and even to have known the words to speak would have been a rare thing.
But that would have been during the time of Artegall's rule, said Artus. I never heard of Hugh or William in the histories.
Maybe these are the histories that changed, murmured Charles.
The unravelling and reweaving the Morgaine spoke of.
What happened next, John? Asked Jack. Does it say? John quickly scanned the remainder of the passage. Suddenly, his eyes grew wide and the blood drained from his face. Artus gripped his friend by the shoulders in support, and finally the caretaker Principia spoke.
Bacon called out to them as they boarded the ship, John said hoarsely. A ship with a large eye inset in the upraised prow, under the head of a great serpent.
That's impossible,
Bert shouted, startling the others out of the subdued calmness they'd affected.
Impossible, he repeated, shaking. I won't believe it.
You recognize the ship? Asked Jack. It sounds just like one of the dragon ships, but not one I remember.
That ship, Bert exclaimed, is the Red Dragon.
There's more, said John, who was still focused on the text. Bacon cried out to them, and for a moment it seemed as if the sound of his voice cleared away the mist that had settled over their minds. We have claimed our inheritance, Hugh replied to Bacon. Tell our father that, and this also, that we will pursue our own crusade as he did before us, and ours will be mighty, and rend this world from heaven to Hades.
That's our myth, said Charles. We...
There is more, John exclaimed, standing and shaking his head from side to side. But this can't be right. He held the book closer to the lamp, then examined both sides of the paper. The dust on it was clotted and well absorbed into the paper. The book had not been opened in many centuries.
It has to be a forgery,
John whispered, to no one in particular. There's no other explanation for this. He turned back to the others, his disbelief almost tangible. The last entry, John said slowly. Hugh and William guided the boat back into the sea. Then, as Bacon watched, they sailed it straight toward a great stone bluff, whose face split open to receive the ship. As it passed through, the ethereal whistling in the air became stronger, and Hugh's countenance grew cloudy again. But William turned and looked at Bacon with tear-brimmed eyes and called out to him, Tell Peter and Jamie, I call Ollie Oxenfree, William said. And then the stone portal slammed closed, leaving not even a seam in the rock. Tell Peter and Jamie, John repeated, almost choking on the words. That's what William the Pig said. I think he was trying to pass a message to James Barry and Peter Pan by giving it to Roger Bacon 700 years ago.
Part 3. The Search for the Red Dragon. Chapter 9. Shadows in Flight. The fire popped and crackled as the chill of evening began to deepen throughout the cave. The old man lifted his head and looked at the cave walls, which were covered with paintings. Most of the pictures were of animals, but several were of men, or creatures that resembled men. It was hard to tell. Some of the images were ancient. Others were much more recent and still glistened, wet in the firelight. Those immediately opposite where the old man was sitting were so fresh that the paint dripped into a pool that had formed at his feet. There, The paint mingled with the blood that was streaming its way down his calves, and he realized with a sudden clarity that his blood and the paint on the walls were practically indistinguishable.